Welcome to the CDI CTO podcast presented by CDI Studios.
Welcome to CDI CTO podcast. My name is Felix Vargas. I am the CTO of security for CDI. Today, we're going to be diving into security with Jonathan Nguyen. He is the VP and global field CISO at Fortinet. Jonathan is a widely published cybersecurity expert with over 25 years of experience. I hear you have a patent in IoT security.
I do.
And you are you serve as the global security strategist for Fortinet as well.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll explore the beginnings of Jonathan's career in cybersecurity. I think it's important for folks to get a frame of reference as to how you got started.
Yeah.
We'll discuss platform versus best of breed. Sure. That comes up all the time in conversations. Yep. We'll also delve into SASE and zero trust.
Yep.
And we'll chat about generative AI. Why not?
Yeah.
Right? That seems to be the topic of conversation that we're all talking about.
Yeah.
So Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. I know that you had to travel to get here, so thank you. How are you today?
I'm well. You know, I've had a good cup of iced coffee. I'm ready to go.
Excellent. All right. So look, we'll jump right in.
Yeah.
How did you get started in cybersecurity?
You know, I got started first in public sector. Mm-hmm. Before that, during my MBA program, I was interested in cybersecurity because I thought that was the best way to pay off my student loans, to be honest with you. And at that point, there was not a cybersecurity program, let alone. So I kind of developed my own concentration. This was over at the George Washington University. And
it was a
background in IT and what was then called network security, right?
Okay, yeah.
And then from there, I got into public sector with the Foreign Service, and that gave me exposure to encryption, to intelligence and counterintelligence. really great time. That's one of the best formative periods of my life in terms of that exposure and understanding how things work, how things don't work.
Right.
The time at the Foreign Service Institute, really valuable. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I joined what was then Bell Atlantic.
No, oh, wow.
And so I was one of the first product managers for what was considered managed security services, which was managed firewalls at that point.
Right.
And then I was part of the leadership team that built that into Verizon's managed security services line of business. And I was part of that leadership team that became the world's largest MSSP at one point. And then after that, progressively my 16 years at Verizon, I ended there as the security CTO, where my role was to make decisions on technologies that we would implement and partnerships that we would enter into. And I had the great privilege of leading and having on the team the Data Breach Investigations Report. And working with that team gave me a lot of insight into the true nature of what was happening in cybersecurity, what was working, what's not working.
Right.
That's my origin story. And I think it's interesting because I was having a conversation with a recruiter a while ago, and this recruiter said, "So what's your superpower, Jonathan?" I said, "Well, if you're going to go down the Marvel Comics route, you should really understand what my origin story is, and then you'll understand the superpower, right?" And by the way, I think just about every CISO should really understand that.
Right.
Articulate your origin story and then understand which superpower you possess.
I love that you call it that, the origin story. I'm definitely going to steal that. So we talked about this a bit off camera around the DC area being a hotbed for cybersecurity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, you know, originally it was because we had great internet access in the area. So the data center growth was there. We also had federal government. So you had the fort, of course, with Fort Meade and the intelligence community there.
Right.
You have the FBI in Quantico, Marine Corps cyber as well in the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. But in the last 5 years, we've had all types of IT companies from the West Coast, from Silicon Valley move in. So Google, Amazon, Yahoo.
Right.
And so also, the tax basis in Virginia is very attractive.
Right.
And so now you've got this confluence of all things. You've got relatively cheap internet access. You've got a body of expertise locally.
Right.
And you've got the tax basis to enjoy business there. And you have, six major universities that are constantly generating people.
So I said DC area, and you said Virginia. So is there... It's more Virginia than anything else.
It's more Virginia because I think Virginia's tax basis is very attractive,
okay.
But also because of the infrastructure along the Colonial Pipelines.
Right,
and you see
right.
the data center growth in Loudoun County, which mm-hmm. became one, the country's most richest county in the last 6 years.
Oh, wow. Loudoun's yeah. incredible.
Loudoun, yeah. Prince William County, it's right. all the data center growth that's there. But at the same time, you have Crystal City. So you have Amazon, Google, right. Yahoo moving into those spaces as well. So, right. yeah.
So I live in Maryland.
Yep.
And growing up, and I grew up in Maryland as well, but growing up, you wouldn't really go to Virginia,
yeah.
right? And so I started going to Virginia when I started to evolve in my career.
Okay.
And then the more I went to Virginia, yeah. the more I wanted to live in Virginia.
Ah.
But at that point, the kids were already in school.
Yeah.
They were deeply rooted with their relationships. So we didn't want to uproot them. But Virginia is just evolving into yeah. an incredible place.
But see, I'm the opposite. I work and live in Virginia, but I run away to the Eastern Shore to the Chesapeake on weekends.
yeah, I do as well.
Yeah.
So a lot of, and we talked about this, right? There are a lot of folks that are looking to get into cybersecurity,
sure.
right?
Yeah.
I think that the responsibility from a cybersecurity perspective should be across the board.
Yeah.
Every organization down to the, you know, an end user,
yeah.
they are a cybersecurity professional to some degree,
yeah.
right? What advice would you give to someone getting into cybersecurity now?
Sure. So I think cybersecurity now is part of everyone's responsibility, as you just outlined.
Yeah.
If you want to get into cybersecurity, the first thing is to understand what it is and why it is. And
right.
cybersecurity, like networking, always follows computing, right? So
right.
the object of the exercise in cybersecurity is to ensure the access to and the security of the applications. But now, cybersecurity are three elements. It's risk management, it's compliance, and it's business enablement. So the first thing I would advise someone, in fact, I was advising some computer science candidates recently, and I asked them, so what are you studying to do right now? And they, to a person, they all said, well, we're preparing to be sysadmins. And I said, well, how many of you believe that when you go into your career maybe six years from now or so, that you're actually going to be sitting at a console, configuring, managing, actually operating a particular technology or vendor? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, are you going to build your own computing? Are you building data centers and operating data centers? Or are you going to consume computing as a utility? And they said, well, most likely we'll be consuming it as a utility.
Right.
I said, so if you're consuming computing as a utility, do you think your security would be consumed as a utility as well? So, yeah, most likely. So and I asked them, so why are you studying to be sysadmins? Right? I mean, if you're not going to be driving the car because it's going to be a fully level 5 autonomous vehicle in the next
right,
6 years,
right.
why are you taking time to study how to be a car mechanic or how to drive? You
right.
should be worried about the governance aspects of it, right? So I would advise right now that having a solid basis in networking, understanding that, understanding computing science, understanding security, but mostly also understanding governance. So the object of the exercise moving forward is how do we as security professionals enable a reasonable level of due care in the identification and management of risk while we balance that with compliance requirements, but we also enable the business. And I think that's going to be the differentiator right now, because you see that in the industry. When you ask most CISOs, what do they struggle with? It's not the technology.
Right.
They struggle with, how do I deal with the larger enterprise? How do I deal with the CMO?
Right.
You know, how do I deal with the CFO? How do I understand the efficiency, velocity, and productivity of capital as it relates to my business case? How do I define and demonstrate an ROI on my security investments, right?
So there are a couple paths to sort of getting that.
Yeah.
You know, you could, you know, go to school and get experience, or you could just go directly into the workforce.
You
could be, you know, you could learn on your own, right? Self-paced.
Yeah.
What would you recommend?
I would say, you know, right now, public sector. I mean, one of the most underappreciated things about not only federal civilian, mm-hmm. but military, is that you have access to technologies and responsibilities that are far ahead of your age. Right.
Okay.
So if you have an opportunity to go into U.S. Cyber Command to work in cyber at any of the military branches, do that, because they will pay for your training. They'll pay for your bachelor's.
School, right?
Bachelor's.
Yeah.
They'll pay for your master's.
Yeah.
And then you're at 20 years and you have a pension. Really, really high demand skill sets. Otherwise, you know, go into a service provider space or go into a vendor like Fortinet, and Fortinet will give you the basics on
right.
cybersecurity training,
right, right,
understand
right.
that, and then figure out what your superpower is.
Right.
There, you know, I tell people there are two roles in cybersecurity. There's either Kirk or Spock. So Kirk is the business side, right?
Right, right.
And Spock is the operations technology side. And you'll figure out over the first 5 years of your career track, which really excites you, right?
Right.
You know, should I go into the finance side, the operational side, or should I go into the operational side?
Right.
And once you do that, you're looking for positions that give you that level of exposure, and then you make your right career track.
Right.
Yeah.
I love that idea, and I think that it's probably related to why there's such a hotbed of talent from a cybersecurity perspective in D.C., right? Because we have the federal government, to your point earlier. So you brought up Fortinet. That's a perfect segue. So I'm curious, right? So your role, your global CISO.
Yeah.
What's a day in the life?
So for any CISO right now, a day in the life, depending on whether you're mid-market or enterprise, let's just take the enterprise. The average day is about 10 and a half hours. And because you're a CISO and all the surveys indicate that about 60% of your job is actually evangelization. So you're working to get the business to adopt and implement uniform security policies, and you're working in a cross-functional role. So about, out of the 10 and a half hours, 4.5 to 5 hours are just standing committee calls and standing team calls. Then you're going to have about an hour and a half for lunch breaks and admin. So at that point, you're into about 6.5 hours already out of your 10 hours. So now you've got roughly 4 hours left. Of those 4 hours, probably 2 hours are just the wildfires that you're putting out on any given day. The thing about a CISO is all things come to you from below, from above, and from the side. And you're the single throat to choke in some ways.
Right.
And so anytime you're looking at that life, you know, that's a typical day. And it's a stressful job, in fact. You know, there are two things I cite about that, and it's changing the nature of who and what we are and how we work. So Forbes, infamously, about 2 years ago, had a survey, and there's an article, and you can Google it, right? Mm-hmm. And found that one out of every six CISOs medicates using drugs or alcohol.
Wow.
Right? And then last year, the Hydrix and Struggles survey of CISOs said for the first time, concern over personal health is greater than the anxiety associated with a data breach. Because it's, so that's an interesting segue as well, right? So you and I chatted about this earlier. When we first started, the object of the exercise was network security. We were, you know, keeps and moats, and, you know, we're going to protect the network by defending the perimeter for defense, right?
Yep.
And then we realized we really couldn't do that. And then we would, I remember a famous statement from the National Program Protector Director, NPPD, the forebearer to CISA. And the statement was that just about every large American enterprise has been penetrated. The malware has been deployed. We just don't know if it's been detonated
yet. There, right?
So we've gone from, you know, keeping everybody out to presume that you've been under attack and that you've been breached. Now, as we think about zero trust, we're actually assuming compromise. So in some ways, we've actually failed upwards, right?
Right.
The essence of zero trust is assume compromise. And then the other part is like, well, then where's the data? Where's the compromised data? Mm-hmm. And so that's why the stress loads are so high. It's because you get pressures from above and below. So the day of the life is that way. But the first time now that Hydras and Struggles, the survey said that CISOs are more concerned about their personal health than they are about the anxieties associated with a breach. Because a breach, now we've gone from it being inevitable to assuming it.
Assuming that it's coming, right?
Yeah.
And preparing for
that's
it.
That's a pretty big change and shift in mindsets, wouldn't you think?
100%. Yeah. And actually, I want to double click on something you said around evangelizing, right, from a CISO perspective.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that? Because part of what I see is siloed departments, right, within organizations.
Yeah.
And the CISO's role is bringing them all together. Right.
So, not only that, there's an entirely emerging role, something called a BISO, the Business Information Security Officer, someone that actually bridges the gap between the CIO and the CISO's organization.
Right.
You know, here's where we are as organizations, right? We traditionally grew up in silos. There's networking, there's security, and there's IT, right? And each one has a separate SVP, separate budget, separate organizational track. So isn't it fascinating that we approach the complexities of cybersecurity, networking, and computing in silos, but the problems we encounter, the adversaries we face, don't come to us in silos. Rarely is it as elegant as a kill chain. Oh, that we beautifully see the recon, we see the attack, compromise, etc. We don't see that because we don't have visibility. And when you look at the stats, what it really shows is why is it that we approach something in silos, but the problems aren't approaching us in silos. In fact, the whole idea that you're going to be able to resolve something in near real time to deliver an exceptional user experience, and by the way, that's been the object of exercise in every major enterprise and every conference I've been to in the last 12 months, because there's this idea that came out of the pandemic that said an enhanced user experience, which is defined as responsive computing, leads to better business and mission outcomes. So what does that mean? It means progressively you want instantaneous responsive computing. Responsive computing is about what I think is neurospeed, right? Neurospeed is what's it? 1/10 of a millisecond,
right?
Something like that. So how is it possible that you can manage across three different silos and deliver a near real-time exceptional experience? So the practical reality is that that's one of the structural issues that we have in cybersecurity.
Right. Now that makes sense. And, you know, that reminds me of security awareness training.
Yeah.
Right. And end users. And, you know, you look at this thing of, you know, not making their job too difficult. Right.
Sure.
And also, you know, I was talking to a pilot recently where they said, as a pilot, if you violate some law, some rule, you know, some traffic violation, if you land and within an hour or so you reported immediately, you get immunity, right?
Yeah.
And so part of the, you know, the challenge in cybersecurity is sometimes when an end user clicks on something, they don't want to call and report that because they're potentially going to face consequences, right?
Yeah.
So how do we sort of get beyond that point?
Yeah, that reminds me of a funny event years ago. I had a friend of mine call me up really early in the morning. He said, hey, Jonathan, you work in network security. I said, yeah. So what's this Anna Kournikova thing that going on right now? And I said, oh, man. Yeah. So security awareness training, it's everyone's responsibility because we are the front line.
Right.
There are four stats that I cite that tells me about where we really are in cybersecurity. So this year, we both know this, we're going to spend, Gartner will tell you, we'll spend $185, $186 billion in network security. More money than we've ever spent on cybersecurity, right?
Yes.
More people than ever working in cybersecurity. Yes. More job openings than ever before. And yet, here are the stats that frame our true state of cybersecurity. The first comes from Gartner, that 99% of all the vulnerabilities exploited were known for at least a year.
Right.
The second will come from our own FortiGuard research. It says 83% of all data breaches were caused by simple human error.
Okay.
You know, security awareness training. The third will come from my old shop at Verizon that says the number one primary source of data breaches and disruptions in cloud are misconfigurations.
Right.
So think about that. We fail on asset management, configuration management, security awareness training. And then there's a maturity curve in cybersecurity, right?
Right.
So we started off with blind because we didn't have instrumentation. Then we started deploying point defense systems. We went to reactive.
Right.
Then we say, well, we need to look at logs and log management, log analysis, and SIEMs versus SEMs. So we get to proactive, right? And then with the nirvana state of AI, and we'll talk about AI, we'll get to predictive.
Right.
So
right.
If you look at the research, depending on who it is, the research suggests that somewhere between 50% and upwards of 72% of all data breach notifications are done by third parties.
Right.
Meaning law enforcement says you're owned, researcher says you're owned.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that tell you? In the year that we spend the most, employ the most, between half to 7 out of 10 times, the internal security team didn't even know they were owned. And yet today, the SEC says you have to notify the SEC, the government, within, 4 days?
4 days,
of a material impact. Heck, if 7 out of 10 organizations can't even tell you they've been compromised, let alone the material impact of it, right?
Yeah.
So now you're beginning to see what I mean.
Interesting stat, right? 99% of cyber attacks begin with a vulnerability that we already
have,
right? So we knew about it for a year's time, right? You know, part of what I see in vulnerability management is the lack of context, right? You know, vulnerability affecting a system that isn't patched is different than affecting a patch system.
Sure.
Vulnerability affecting a tier one system is different than affecting an isolated system, right? So I feel like in general, we lack context around what is important to do next. Do you think that's part of the problem?
Absolutely, because context is based upon awareness.
Right.
So if you can't even see what you have, how can you have context around it, right? So the first issue I see in structural issues in cybersecurity is disaggregated systems that are not integrated.
Right.
The second aspect of vulnerability management is that, you know, we think that there is an issue with regards to the criticality of a vulnerability versus its exploit rate. And there is research, my friend Wade will tell you from Scientia, that that may not be the case. That there may not be a direct relationship between the criticality of an SVE, and its exploit rate.
Yeah, right.
And so what it comes out is context is key. Understanding what's critical for your organization, and understanding your prioritization of patching. And I will tell you that patching is hard. You know, there's some people who say patching is all you have to do, Jonathan. Every Tuesday, it's like a Jiffy Lube. Every 5,000 miles, you have to do an oil change.
So it's obviously hard.
You haven't had an operational role where you can't take the enterprise offline at some Greenwich Mean Time, right?
Just to patch it. Yeah.
And if you don't know what you have, how can you patch it? Because no one takes anything, no one takes things down because we're so afraid that it'll have a cascading effect of unintended consequences.
Other systems.
So I will tell you that if I were going back in the operational role, there are a few things I would absolutely take with me. Mm-hmm. The compensating control of automated posture checks that are built into things like Zero Trust Network Access and SASE, the ability to do authentication, validation, and log and monitor for every session, really understanding, is that really Jonathan?
Right. Is that Jonathan? Verify explicitly, right?
Is Jonathan's device properly configured and patched and sits behind a firewall, has encryption enabled, and then to do that role-based access control, that validation, do it for every session. So what we begin to realize is the level of complexity that we've built over time forces us to think about compensating controls that are always on, always running in the background. In fact, one of the ways that I would go about demonstrating reasonable care today is to demonstrate that I can do that. Yes, I have a rigorous approach to application vulnerability management, asset management, configuration management, but at the same time, I understand how tough that really is. And so I have these automated security posture checks running in the background for every session.
Right.
You know, and so we begin to see that we've gone from a hermetically sealed environment where we can keep everybody out and only let legitimate users in. Mm-hmm. Now we assume the compromise, assume the breach. And so the object of the exercise, and this is now precedent coming back from a pretty large data breach a few years ago, is that we have to manage to a reasonable level of due care. And that's a 15th century construct of English common law that says, you know, what would a reasonable person do knowing what he or she knows that moment in time? So it's
right.
So there used to be three questions we're after in the aftermath of a data breach. There are four now. There's like, what did you know? When did you know it?
Right.
What did you do about it? And was it reasonable? Right. So you and I are just discussing that 99% of the vulnerabilities exploited were known for at least a year.
Yeah.
And so what did we do about it?
Maybe nothing.
And is it reasonable?
Right.
The reasonable test is, I think, what the subjectivity is what makes CISOs and security professionals so critical, because each of us in our organizations have to determine what is reasonable for us as a risk, given our risk exposure, our risk posture, our risk tolerance, you know?
How much risk we want to assume.
Yeah. Right?
And also, just a point, you know, based on what you said, is some things just simply can't be patched, right? So you have to manage that risk.
That's right.
Right? And you can't patch everything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There are a lot of OT environments that you can't touch, right? There's a lot of systems that, like you said, can't be brought offline. So it's definitely interesting. Well, with that, you know, that concludes our chat today on, CDI CTO podcast. Thank you so much for coming.
Always.
Right? I know that you had to travel to get here, so I appreciate you being here. It's a great conversation. Also, a special thank you to the dedicated production team, AJ and Spencer, always working and editing these videos and publishing them. So appreciate that. And most importantly, thank you for tuning in.
Thank you for watching the CDI CTO podcast. Part 2 of this episode will release on September 12th. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also watch and subscribe to our YouTube channel at CD Integration, where you can stay up to date on everything CDI. And check out our other podcast, SAs and IPAs. This project is produced by CDI Studios.